Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. As the song goes, Les Wexner did make money off of girls and women and men, billions. The singer Jax has called the song an anthem for a generation. And despite its upbeat tone, the song expresses the anger she felt about body image issues perpetuated by the company. As Wexner faces intense scrutiny over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein, we look anew at his origin story in retail that started right here in Columbus. The billion-dollar empire he built included some of the top stores of their day. The song mentions Victoria's Secret, but there was also Pink, The Limited 2, Express, Abercrombie & Fitch, and more. And he helped create the fast fashion trend, the shopping mall as a mecca. He greenlit Sex Sells marketing campaigns and high-end fashion shows featuring supermodel angels. And along the way, he gave away millions upon millions of dollars, transforming his hometown and his alma mater. Joining us now is full-time freelance journalist Tim Farron. He's a reporter, and he has reported on the Epstein files and the Wexner congressional deposition, and he worked for the Columbus Dispatch for 30 years, where his business beat included covering Wexner and the ups and downs of his businesses. Welcome to All Sides, Tim.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks, Amy.
So have you heard that the song that we played at the top, Victoria's Secret? I wanted to ask you about one of the lines in the song in particular, where the singer says it was all made up by a dude. So I mean, that's true. Victoria's Secret was started by a dude. But
it
actually
wasn't Les Wexner.
Yes,
though.
It actually wasn't Les Wexner. It was a brainchild of a guy named Roy Raymond. Can you tell me about him?
I'm not all that familiar with him. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that out in the West Coast, he started this brand, Victoria's Secret, and he was kind of scraping by. He had a shop, and as it happens, Les Wexner heard about it, visited the shop, and saw something, as Les has done many times. Abercrombie & Fitch, for instance, was famously a sporting goods company that Ernest Hemingway shopped at. Mm-hmm. And then Les bought it and said, I see something here we can turn around. Same thing with Victoria's Secret. He saw something there, gave Roy Raymond $1 million, and said, I'll take the intellectual rights, that is the brand, and we'll transform this into something a little bit different.
Hmm. Yeah, so that was 1982. Mm-hmm. Raymond sells it to him for $1 million. But
and he should have kept just 1 or 2%, right?
If only. Poor Roy Raymond, yes. But does Wexner have any involvement in Victoria's Secret today? I know that he announced in 2020 that he was stepping down as the chair. He sold a majority stake to a private equity firm.
Right.
What happens then?
He's cashed out. Mm-hmm. Basically, he's enjoying sort of semi-retirement, if you will. He no longer has any control over Victoria's Secret or Bath & Body Works, or any of the other brands that are or used to be part of limited brands.
Mm. So. Of the many companies he owned in the 80s and 90s, he doesn't have ownership of any of them anymore.
No.
But we're going to talk about some of it in more detail, the evolution and the marketing of Victoria's Secret, the catalogs. We'll talk about that later in the hour. But I thought it would be interesting to learn more about Les Wexner building his empire. So he started out at a very young age alongside his parents.
Right.
So Bella and Harry Wexner. Can you tell me a little bit about them?
Bella was a force of nature. She was reputedly the youngest merchant buyer for, I want to say, Lazarus. And she and her husband, Harry, decided to open their own small shop, and they named it Leslie's after their beloved son, which it kind of gives you a little bit of a hint on why Les was so driven over the years to succeed, because he was their pride and joy. He was the oldest, and he was going to succeed or die trying, I think. At a certain point, the story Les has told is his parents went on vacation, their first vacation ever, and Les was looking over the books at Leslie's, the store, and he realized that there were certain items that were selling much more than other items, and those items that weren't selling much, they were kind of higher priced, and shouldn't we be selling the ones that were really selling? And thus the idea for the limited, a limited number of items. And, you know, that's a nice story. But in fact, what happened was he hit the zeitgeist, if you will. It was right around the early 60s, and the post-war baby boom era was really flowering. And the middle class was really starting to pick up and become a major, major buying sector. And so Les saw this and had what's called in the business sportswear. Basically what you and I wear right now, not, you know, shorts and T-shirts, but
like what we call wear. Business casual now.
Business casual, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so he opened a store. He got a loan from his Aunt Ida, $5,000. And he took that money and went to the bank and put it in a, you know, deposited it so that he would have credit. And the bank gave him credit to open The Limited, the first shop in Kingsdale.
Yeah, that was 1963.
And my wife actually remembers shopping there with her mother. And they were nice quality goods, kind of fashionable, the casual things that you want, where you can go to work in them, you can go to a picnic in them, you can do a lot of things, and it's not just a suit and tie or a formal dress. And so that was, they were well-made things, and Les really hit it, and he started opening one limited store a year for the next 6 years, I think. And by 1969, he had about six limited stores around the region, and he decided to go public, start offering stock. And then that was just an explosion. He was also part of the mall rollout around the country. And hundreds of stores followed suit. He realized that there's a certain limit to the limited that you can do, and then started opening other brands, Express, Limited 2 for kids. He ultimately had just multi-retail company with things like Abercrombie & Fitch and,
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the empire Les Wexner built in retail with full-time freelance journalist Tim Farron. He worked at the Columbus Dispatch for 30 years, where his business beat included covering Wexner and the ups and downs of his business. So Wexner had so many different types of stores, from Abercrombie & Fitch, Victoria's Secret, Limited 2.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't build a mall without five or six Les Wexner stores,
that
right?
That was the point. And he was opening hundreds of stores every year during those boom, go-go years and making tons and tons of money, of course. And especially when he realized early on, one of his executives said, you know, this is really nice stuff that we're merchandising. How about if we source it someplace where the wages are kind of low? So let's start making these really nice plaid skirts. My wife bought one at the original limited store, and she said it was lovely. It was lined. I had it for years. And so when she saw a limited store out in California some years later, she thought, oh, I can get that kind of thing there. Well, no. It was made in Southeast Asia, slightly cheaper material.
Not the same.
Not the same at all, but close enough so that he could ride the wave of fashion and
What we call fast fashion now.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever the latest trend was, Les was on top of it.
Yeah. So give us a sense of how the Wexner money came to transform Columbus as a community. The money to Ohio State is well documented.
Right.
But there's other charitable giving that he's done that listeners may be less familiar with. Can you tell me some of the ways Wexner has put his money in Central Ohio?
Well, of course, there's New Albany and there's Easton Town Center. One of the early things that he did... the old governor's mansion, which the Columbus Foundation is now their headquarters, Les spent the money to convert that from a governor's mansion into the lovely headquarters for the Columbus Foundation.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. And yes. And then, of course, as I said, Easton and New Albany. Interesting thing about Easton and New Albany. Les, in college at Ohio State, one of his favorite courses was urban planning. Mm-hmm. And he had an idea that he wanted to basically transform downtown Columbus into this multi-purpose area that Easton and New Albany. But at the time, when he approached the mayor and the city leadership, it was a really, really heavy lift, of course, because you didn't have an entire swath of land that you could do anything with.
Mm-hmm.
You had all of these many different owners of many different shops. And so they said, Les, that's just, no, that's not possible. And he went away and said, well,
I'll do
it someplace else on all of this land that I've acquired on the east side there. And hence, he makes Easton Town Center and of course, New Albany. Jack Kessler drove him around all of this open farmland and said, well, we could really make something here.
I think this area needs some white picket fences, right?
And white picket fences and Georgian mansions and maybe a school that looks like the old campus of the University of Virginia and on and on and on. And so at one point, it was in the early 90s, Les, through the New Albany Company, he owned more than 90% of New Albany. He could do whatever he wanted, and he did, and, you know.
So you had a one-on-one interview with Les Wexner a number of years back, but it wasn't easy to get. I mean, tell me, he's not known for doing a lot of interviews.
No.
Can you describe that process, how you got the interview, and then maybe give us a sense of the man you talked to?
Well, my editors at the Dispatch said, would it be really great? We haven't done, a one-on-one with Les in ages. Can you get one? And I said, let me see. So I started talking to the PR representative there or emailing them once a week, every week, for a year.
Oh, wow.
And, they kept coming back and saying, well, can you give us kind of just a rough idea so that he knows what to prepare to say and so on. And I said, yeah, I think we can do that without compromising our, integrity. And so ultimately they said, he's met you. You had interviewed Abigail about her Olympic horse. Yeah, it's not like you're some stranger coming in that, okay. So we sat down and as it happens, once you get Les rolling, he just keeps rolling and rolling and rolling. And it was, it was a great interview, really. And he was pleased with it. My editors were pleased with it. It was in some ways revealing, in other ways just kind of more of his sort of image building.
Yeah.
But, he was quite open and honest as he as he wanted to be
yeah.
in that discussion.
Well, I wanted to add that we did email Wexner's spokesperson about a week ago to invite Wexner or a company representative to be on the to be a guest on the show today.
Great.
Or to provide a statement about the and we did not receive a reply to our email, but I guess we have to try it once a week for a year. So I'll take note of that. So I did want to ask you just we're going to run out of time, so I have to fast forward a little bit.
Yeah.
But I wanted to fast forward to you've reported on the Epstein files.
Right.
You listened to his hours of testimony at the deposition that
took
place at his estate in New Albany. Wexner was a very wealthy man.
Yeah.
And when it comes to Jeff Epstein, do you know why he put Jeff Epstein in his orbit? What's your best explanation as to why he came to trust Jeff Epstein so completely?
Well, we've talked about this a lot, my co-writer, Mark Williams, and I, and we really think, based on everything that I've talked to people who have been around Les for years, Les was a very driven man, very driven. And during the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the typical story was that he'd get on the corporate jet, and they'd with a bunch of merchant buyers, and they'd fly out from Port Columbus to London. Mm-hmm. And but overnight flight, he wouldn't sleep. He'd sit there, and the merchant buyers would be sitting around with their binders, and he'd pepper them with questions. Mm-hmm. And they'd give reports, and they'd have everything plotted out. And by the time they got to Heathrow, there was a lineup of cars to take them all around, and they would start buying things and finding fashion tips and so forth. And they would go relentlessly all day, all night, come back to Columbus. And by the time they got back, Les would be practically carried out to a waiting car and taken home. I mean, he was that relentless, driven, I think because of his parents just nudging him on. Bella had a an office right across the hall from Les at Limited Brand headquarters. And so here's a guy, and here's a con man, Jeffrey Epstein, who sees this guy who basically has no life other than his job. And he's got all this money. He's a huge success. And Epstein sees a mark. He sees a guy who's a billionaire, and he can tap into that. And Epstein figured, well, you know, I can be his go-to fixer, the guy who deals with all sorts of things and makes sure that everything goes well. And I'll find a nanny after he marries somebody and has a kid. Well, you know, Jeffrey can do that. Jeffrey knows everybody. Jeffrey can... He has all these connections.
In the deposition, Wexner said repeatedly that they were just business associates and they were not friends. Did you buy that?
No.
Okay.
No. And we know that's really not true, because if you look through the files that have been dropped, the tranches of emails and so on, at one point, Les sends an email to Epstein talking about some incident in which one of Les's kids is laughing about Uncle Jeffrey.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, my close friends, they have kids, and do they call me Uncle Tim? Hmm. Not necessarily. They could, but holy cow, that's just...
That would be a lot for a business associate.
That's a lot for a business associate, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming and telling us about your experience covering Les Wexner. We've been talking about Wexner's retail empire with full-time freelance journalist Tim Farron. He worked at the Columbus Dispatch for 30 years, where his business beat included covering Wexner and the ups and downs of his business. Thank you for your time today, Tim.
You're very welcome. Thanks, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to dive deeper into how Victoria's Secret, through sexy marketing and iconic fashion shows, shapes the beauty standards of the culture. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube, but what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
God, I wish somebody would have told me when I was younger. All bodies aren't the same. Photoshop bitty bitty models on magazine covers. Told me I was overweight. I stopped eating. What a bummer. Can't have carbs in a hot girl summer. If I could go back and tell myself when I was younger, I'd say, psst.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This song by Jax went viral in 2022 and summed up how many women came to feel about the Victoria's Secret brand. Impossible beauty standards defined by supermodels strutting as angels in lingerie and apparel that didn't fit all shapes and sizes. We are revisiting how Les Wexner made his money in light of his recent scrutiny over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. This hour, we look anew at the billion-dollar retail empire he built and headquartered here in Columbus. Joining us now is Dr. Rachel Rogers, professor of psychology at Northeastern University. Her research focuses on mental health and the sociocultural influences on body image and eating concerns. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Rogers.
Good morning. Thank you.
And also joining us is journalist Chantal Fernandez. She is a feature writer for The Cut, covering fashion, retail, luxury, and beauty. Welcome to the show, Chantal.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So Chantal is also the co-author of a 2024 book, along with journalist Lauren Sherman, which is titled Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret and the Unraveling of an American Icon. So I wanted to start with you. Your book is a fascinating read, detailed, an even-handed look at Les Wexner and his business, especially his flagship store, Victoria's Secret. So related back to the song we just played by Jax, you write about it in your book. In the summer of 2022, Victoria's Secret haters found their anthem. So what do you think gave rise to the song? Like, why did it hit a nerve, I guess?
I think people were looking for someone to verbalize how maybe Victoria's Secret had made them feel when they were younger or when they were teenagers. And that kind of feeling of representing an American beauty standard that was difficult or impossible to live up to. And as these things do, go viral on TikTok primarily, and it kind of took off and was a catchy song and came at the right time, I think, where Victoria's Secret was in sort of an apologetic period. So the timing was right.
Yeah. And Les Wexner is no longer a part of Victoria's Secret, and he wasn't when the song came out. But how did newly appointed CEO Amy Hawk respond to the song, and how was her response received?
Yeah, she wrote a sort of apology that kind of that was released on Instagram, on social media, kind of acknowledging past mistakes and saying that the company was, you know, had changed and was working to rebuild their relationship with the customers, earn their trust back. And I think, people are not really that jazzed about letters from CEOs, but it's interesting that they responded to it at all. It's a tricky position for the company to be in at that time. And it was sort of a testament to how popular the song was that they had to address it and say, you know, Wexner's not involved with the company anymore, which they sort of didn't explicitly say, but they tried to say, like, we've already, and it was true, we've already moved into a different chapter of this business and we're working on it.
Distancing themselves from the old man who lives in Ohio, right?
A little
bit. Yeah. Dr. Rogers, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of the lyrics heard in the song. She sings about Hunger Games, not eating carbs in order to have a hot girl summer. And then the song ends with the line, I know Victoria's secret. She was never made for me and you. What do you think about when you hear that song?
Well, to me, those lyrics echo what Chantal was just saying about the unrealistic and unachievable nature of these appearance ideals and the images that we see. The Victoria's Secret's models in themselves don't look like the pictures that we see of them. And most models do not. And so I think that the song's really highlighting the fact that this angel, this Victoria's Secret, doesn't actually exist, and she's definitely not meant to be embodied by anybody.
In recent days, as more of the Epstein files have come to light, further cementing Epstein's association with Wexner, a number of millennial women had started posting on social media, blaming Victoria's Secret for contributing to long-term body issues and even eating disorders. So, Rachel Rogers, you know, back in Victoria's Secret's prime, it was catalogs, fashion shows, TV ads. What is the connection, in your opinion, between the images we see and how we feel about ourselves?
Great question. There has been a lot of evidence accumulated over the past decades as we've transitioned through magazines and to other forms of more interactive media, that the effects of images that we see on the way that we experience ourselves are in some ways unconscious. We see images, we're drawn to compare ourselves to them. If an image is an unrealistic one, we always end up short. But they're also, these effects are also due to the stories that the images tell. And the story is often one that contains, let's say, some lies. One of them being that if you end up looking this way, you will be happy and your life will be perfect. And the other one being that through enough time, effort, and purchasing of products and services, you could actually change your appearance and transform yourself to this extent. And all of those things are untrue.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how Les Wexner built his billion-dollar retail empire here in Central Ohio. We're talking with Dr. Rachel Rogers, Associate Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University, and fashion journalist Chantal Fernandez, co-author of the book Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret and the Unraveling of an American Icon. Chantal, I want to delve into the early days of Victoria's Secret because it might be hard to imagine today. But back then, it was a novel concept, you know, lingerie going mainstream. Victoria's Secret under Wexner didn't start out promoting like hypersexualized messaging. It did that. It goes through iterations at first. Can you talk to me about what it looked like earlier on? What was Victoria's Secret at the start?
Yeah, when Wexner acquired it, it was a very different business. It was a small chain of stores in the Bay Area, started by a husband and wife, Roy and Gay Raymond. And it was much more upscale. The store interiors were sumptuous. The catalogs were kind of full of these fantastical settings. You know, it was sexy, but it was also kind of high concept, beautiful images. And the lingerie that they sold was more expensive. It was not Victoria's Secret brands. It was Dior, La Perla, Janet Reger, which was a popular brand at that time. You know, frilly, feminine, kind of Victorian, hence the Victoria's Secret. And I think Wexner recognized, and obviously what happened next proved him to be right, that this was a concept that he could scale across the country as kind of an alternative to Fredericks of Hollywood that was more glamorous, more respectable in a sense. And especially in the 90s, Victoria's Secret advertised a fake headquarters in London. It had a very kind of British manner, you know, Stephanie Seymour in a robe drinking tea in the catalogs. There was something very regal and aristocratic about the image it presented.
In his portfolio, Wexner had Victoria's Secret and then the offshoot Pink, the Limited 2, Abercrombie & Fitch, Bath & Body Works. So, Chantal, you give us a sense. Wexner was considered one of the greatest retail merchants in history. The New York Times actually called him the Merlin of the Mall. Can you tell me more about that? I mean, would malls have existed the way they were without Les Wexner?
Definitely not. Wexner was the king of the mall. And it's hard to underestimate the influence he's had on the way that we shop. He didn't invent this idea of specialty retailing, but he perfected it and he scaled it. And even when he started The Limited, his own father didn't think that people would come to one store just to buy one category of thing, like The Limited store sold women's sportswear. Now we're used to that idea. We go to one place for jeans, one place for sneakers. he recognized that model and its potential and really disrupted the department stores and scaled through malls in a tremendous way and opened thousands and thousands of stores across all these different brands, and did so with an eye towards having a sharp point of view at each of these brands, you know, and especially with Victoria's Secret and Bath and Body Works, arguably his most successful brands, where you really understood from the marketing, from the store design, from the catalogs, what this business was about, what it was selling you, and what you could find there. And it was sort of theatrical retail in a sense, and to the point where for a very long time, Wexner was famous for not advertising, which is funny to think about with Victoria's Secret now. But, you know, for many years, the stores were the advertisement that he needed because he had them in all the malls where everyone was shopping.
One thing that struck me is you write that women were key in decision-making positions from the earliest days of the stores. And they saw one of the missions of Victoria's Secret as empowering women, promoting healthy images of women with satisfying sex lives. You talk about that in your book. So tell me more about the woman vision versus the Wexner vision, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, Wexner hired and promoted women across all of his brands, especially Victoria's Secret. You know, a lot of these women became extremely wealthy and had a ton of control over this business and didn't see it as maybe the kind of vision you have of it today. They saw it as an indulgence, a way for women to feel great about themselves. You know, there was, for many years internally, there was what they called a wheel of sexy, like a diagram that outlined all these different ways that women could feel about themselves. And the idea being that the brand needed to hit all of them, even though maybe what we were getting from the fashion shows or from the television commercials was just a sliver of it. So there was different intentions at different points. And there was always this internal conversation about what is sexy? What do women want? That's how the line Body by Victoria, which was very much about comfort, everyday wear, that emerged like in the early 2000s, was extremely successful for the company. It was a reflection of that. So it doesn't always align with what we saw in these like Michael Bay television commercials where there's a helicopter exploding behind a model in lingerie. But, you know, mass marketing is not the most hospitable to nuance, obviously.
Dr. Rachel Rogers, I want to bring you back into the conversation here. Can you tell me the difference between the empowerment of women versus the objectifying of women? I mean, how can we tell the difference?
Absolutely. Objectification is a process whereby people, often women, are reduced to objects rather than being considered as people. And this objectification is often sexualized. So it's essentially, you are no longer a person. You are a sexy thing that I can use for my own pleasure and gratification. This is a process that we see occur through the discourse and the imagery around women and other gender in our society. So many of the mass media images that Chantal was just referring to of the women in the lingerie in an improbable situation, that is a prime example of objectification. She is being the sexy thing in this picture. Empowerment, in contrast, is a concept that's really deeply rooted in feminism and is about feeling that you have agency over your own self and subjectivity. And that is a construct that is understood to move people towards a place where they feel that they have a sense of control and power within their own life, that they're able to take decisions, and it's associated with a number of indicators of well-being. Objectification, in contrast, we know is associated with depression and lower sexual satisfaction and, of course, body image and eating concerns.
So do you think that in the 90s and early 2000s, there were women who could look at Victoria's Secret and see completely different things? So some women would look at it and see the objectification side, and other women would look at it and see empowerment and I look beautiful and I have a great sex life. Could you see women seeing both?
I think it's certainly possible. That's true with any image, really. At the same time, as we were saying, one of the things that mass media does deliberately is flattening complexity. And so most likely you're going to see whatever the dominant story is. And in our culture, that dominant story is really one of objectification.
Okay, so I'm giving it too much. I'm giving it to both sides. Chantal, you described Wexner as being hands-on with his companies in terms of ideas and vision. Did he micromanage his stores? Give me a sense of how he ran things. Would he make decisions about what the angels look like and whether there's an exploding helicopter?
I don't think that he was making decisions about the exploding helicopter, mm-hmm. but I think he was making bigger picture decisions about the direction of kind of the idea of what the angels represented. And it was his idea to kind of name a line of bra angels to begin with, which is interesting. And it kind of, it's avalanched into this franchise that the company built it into. But He was in the stores. He was really hands-on in sort of merchandising meetings and following the data. He was really well known for what he called patterning, which is recognizing patterns in the market and extrapolating that and thinking about, okay, you know, I've noticed that people are drinking martinis again, and maybe they're not going to be wanting to wear flannels while they drink martinis. There's going to be a shift towards dressing up more. That's just like an example from the 90s. Or noticing, you know, that his brands had gotten muddled, like the Limited and Express at one point. I think consumers were confusing what they were, and he hired consultants to help him understand, okay, we need to have a really clear cinematic idea behind each of these brands so the customers understand what they're coming to us for and what we sell. So I think it was both big picture micromanaging, and then sometimes, depending on which businesses needed the most help, sort of in the fine details as well.
Yeah. When I think back to it, I can remember shopping at both the Limited and Express. And when I think about it, I was like, I could afford the Limited ish and fit into the clothes, and Express I could not afford, and maybe I could pretend to fit into the clothes, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Les Wexner had a fellow Ohio State alumni, Ed, is it Razik? Is that how you, do you know?
Razik.
Ed Razik. Although 10 years younger than Les Wexner, he was hired as Victoria's Secret's chief marketing officer. And he kind of created the supermodel angels, the Heidi Klum, Tyra Banks, Gisele Bündchen, other big names. Did Victoria's Secret define sexy at that time, or did they go along to where society already was?
They didn't invent this idea of sexiness or this American beauty standard. They did not invent it. But I think they came to represent it, to be kind of the standard bearer of that, because they were so effective in their marketing, and because the angels represented sort of this elite group that even the models were auditioning to get into and desperate to get into. So yes, they were just so effective at the way that they marketed that they came to represent that long after maybe things started to change, especially in the mid 2010s, where there was kind of shift towards body positivity and more diversity in marketing. But there was, in the mid 90s, I sort of trace this back to an experience that Victoria's Secret had around the push-up bras, which is that they had a miracle bra that didn't come out of the gate very strong compared to the Wonder Bra, which was not sold by Victoria's Secret, because the Wonder Bra had this ad called Hello Boys. It was this model, she was heaving cleavage, and it was this huge sensation. And I think the lesson that was taken there was, we need to be advertising to men and to women, and we need to take sort of bigger swings, simplify. So in the 2000s, when American culture was hypersexualized as well, think of MTV, Michael Bay movies, you know, Girls Gone Wild, they were reflecting what was going on. They were picking up what was going on, and in some ways kind of tame by comparison, but saying, okay, there's been a cultural shift here. The 90s, there was this gentility that is no longer cool, and we need to amp it up, have models on Lamborghinis. And they followed that and extremely effectively in the way that they created this franchise around the angels. And sort of long before fashion brands do this now, where they have characters or ambassadors, characters in their universe, and they make their own documentaries, make their own television shows. You know, Victoria's Secret was doing that way before everyone else was.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how Les Wexner built his billion-dollar retail empire here in Central Ohio. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Victoria's Secret and other Wexner brands now have a renewed interest following his recent deposition in the Epstein case. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And yes, Les Wexner is the dude in the Victoria's Secret song we just played. The singer Jax has called the song an anthem for a generation. And despite its upbeat tone, the song expresses the anger she felt about body image issues perpetuated by the company. As Wexner faces intense scrutiny over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein, we look anew at the billion-dollar retail empire he built here in Central Ohio. And the time when Victoria's Secret was the epitome of sex and success, with its provocative catalog and iconic superstar models and fashion shows. In recent days, social media posts from millennial women blame Victoria's Secret for ushering in an era of hypersexualization. Still with us, we have Dr. Rachel Roberts, Associate Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University. Her research focuses on mental health and sociocultural influences on body image and eating concerns. Thanks again for being here, Dr. Rogers. And we also have journalist Chantal Fernandez, co-author of the book Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret, The Unraveling of an American Icon. So Jeffrey Epstein enters Wexner's universe, gets power of attorney, takes over financial matters, lives on an estate on Wexner's property in New Albany. And Wexner seemingly ignores warnings from friends and associates that he was putting too much trust in Epstein. Chantal, does it seem in keeping with how Wexner conducted his businesses? Did he tend to listen to advisors, go with his gut? I mean, are you surprised that he put so much trust in one man?
I mean, that's sort of the unanswered question that has been hanging over Wexner's sort of public reputation since I think everything about Epstein's crimes has been more and more revealed in recent years. And we may never have a full answer to that, but it is unusual. I think, at his deposition 2 weeks ago, he said that he gave power of attorney to the person he hired as his financial advisor after Epstein, and that this was sort of the way he needed to do it. His financial life was too complicated. He's exceptionally wealthy, and he also didn't grow up wealthy. And I think from what we understand that Epstein was sort of offering to other clients is this idea that he could untangle things, especially that it could be really appealing for someone whose life was really complicated and busy, and who was wealthy in a way that he was not accustomed to suddenly. Like, you know, he didn't grow up that way. I think it was a lot to take on. That's probably the nicest way to explain it.
Yeah.
But yes, there's definitely a huge question of like, why trust this person with sort of a dubious background who has now been revealed to be a kind of a con man, as Wexner himself called him, worse than Bernie Madoff.
Wexner said he was conned. But in his recent deposition, Wexner describes their relationship as friendly business associates, but not friends. Chantal, do you buy that?
No, that's not what our reporting in the process of this book showed us, that they were close and that he helped him on many personal matters. But of course, Wexner will say what he wants to say.
Right. Dr. Rachel Roberts, Rogers, what alarm bells go off here in your head when with all that has come to light about all these people, the powerful, wealthy white men in the Epstein files, men redacted in the files, their faces obscured, keeping us in the dark about who they are and what they might have done, legal or illegal. What do you think about with the recent release of these files?
I think one of the things that comes to my mind is that we know that appearance ideals are not random. They exist to be unattainable and unrealistic, but they also serve the people who already hold power and privilege in a society by upholding the characteristics that they are more likely to already have as physical traits. And so that's one thing that it brings to mind, is that this all really highlights how our systems come together to prevent diversity and inclusivity. It also, though, highlights, I think, the objectification and sexualization piece that we were talking about before. Like, one of the ways that that operates is through what we call the symbolic male gaze. And while that doesn't refer to actual men, but more the symbol of the patriarchy, there is no doubt that powerful white men have significantly contributed to patriarchy as an oppressive system and continue to have a lot of interests being served by that system remaining in place.
I do want to add here that we emailed Wexner's spokesperson to invite Wexner or a company representative to be a guest on today's show or to provide a statement, and we did not receive a reply. So, Rachel, in recent days, social media posts from millennial women point to stores like Victoria's Secret and Pink for ushering in an era of hypersexualization, manifesting long-term body issues, eating disorders for some. Are the millennials correct? Did Victoria's Secret and their angels do that? Like, what would it have happened anyway without the Victoria's Secret angels?
I wish I had the answer to that question. I think these things are complex in the way that Chantal was describing about, are we reflecting what women want, or are women being told this is what they want because these are the images that they've grown up seeing? And I'm sure there's a little bit of both. Is there a responsibility with brands who are putting out all of these marketing assets and have these huge buyer bases that include young people? Yes, there definitely is. And I certainly believe that it's their responsibility to be understanding the effects that their marketing assets, imagery, and messaging are causing.
Now, Dr. Rogers, also, it seems like Victoria's Secret was just a launch pad for what social media serves up these days. And I'm not saying that, like, diet culture and ideal body image discussions have gone away. But now on social media, they're living side by side with conversations about body positivity and loving your body. So do you think right now both exist equally, or like which one is winning the algorithm right now?
I would say in terms of what you see most of, even if you're not trying, the idealized content wins hands down. Mm. It's a real uphill struggle to try and curate your online space so as to see more of the other things. It's in all practicalities almost impossible just because of how much idealized imagery there is. And also the really fine line that there is between something that is officially diet content advertising, something that's sponsorship, something that's an influencer, something that's just an individual sharing their journey. It blends, and that makes it even more difficult.
Chantal, Les Wexner was pretty clear that he wasn't developing products for everybody, not all body sizes. Part of that was the visual element, the body perfection. But wasn't part of it also practicality, the mass-produced economy of what sizes he made, just you can't make money if you make every size?
Absolutely. And if you think about bras, for example, it's not small, medium, large. It's 34A, 34B, and on. And even if you're doing, as Victoria's Secret did, a limited size range, that's still a ton of different types of bras, like different SKUs. So, and there was also the strategy of, we don't want to be for everyone, because especially in the 2000s, if you were a brand that was inclusive, that wasn't cool. That wasn't a good business strategy. The idea of being an exclusive place for beautiful women, that was a good business strategy. That was reflective of what was going on in wider consumer culture. What Dr. Rogers was saying, there was, I think Victoria's Secret represented this male fantasy, but women loved it too. And I think there's always this push and pull of being resentful of these beauty standards, but also wanting to fulfill them. And what does that mean when we go to the mall for some cheap thrills, buying a bra or a lacy pair of underwear? I think it's really complicated. And just because we had this period where in fashion advertising, it was more diverse, it was more body positive, as we're seeing now with the rise of, GLP-1s, that fat phobia in our culture never went away. And is still really prevalent, and I think drives a lot of why we buy skincare, why we buy workout leggings. This is this idea of transforming into something else. And I think Wexner really understood that for a really long time at Victoria's Secret. Well, under his, during his years, the idea was, we sell hope, not help. Mm-hmm. So it was never talking about, okay, this bra is super comfortable. It was about, what are you going to look like? What are you going to feel like wearing this from an aesthetic point of view? And I think part of what led to Victoria's Secret's challenges in the second half of the 2010s is that a lot of brands started talking about the help, saying, okay, this is stretchy, this doesn't have the underwire bra. And women were saying, okay, I'd rather go in this direction. I want to feel comfortable. I want to, mm-hmm. My bras are for myself. So there's There's shifts in some ways and yeah. not in others.
We've been talking about the Wexner retail empire as he faces intense scrutiny over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. And we've been talking with Dr. Rachel Rogers, Associate Professor of Psychology at Northeastern University, and fashion journalist Chantal Fernandez, co-author of the book Selling Sexy. Thank you both for joining us today. And we're going to end again with the song from Jax from 2022, an anthem for those who spoke out against body image culture of Victoria's Secret. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
She was never made for me and you.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.